Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, if you could pick a Met Gala theme, what would you pick and who would you expect to be the best dressed?
Oh my goodness, a Met Gala theme. I think I would do something food related.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they don't serve enough food at the Met Gala and there should be something food related. Or just cats, and then we know we would just invite Jared Leto.
You know what? He is a deeply irritating celebrity, but I've got to hand it to him. It was
that was he committed
amazing, amazing work. It's Jared Leto's best work of his entire career. This week, we're joined by Karina Longworth, Kara Klenk, and Michaela Watkins to take on the following questions. What are Hollywood writers striking about? What can film teach us about prevailing social attitudes? Is rejection really the best teacher? And should you go see a pet psychic? All this and more right now. All right, welcome to another week of Hysteria, the podcast that wants Joe Manchin to fuck all the way off, but would 100% accept an invitation to drink champagne on his yacht so that we could steal the champagne.
Yes, and then go drink it on a pier by ourselves.
Exactly. That would be way more fun than being on his yacht. But it'd be fun to do some selfies being like, hey, we're stealing Joe Manchin.
We're here, stealing champagne. Ocean 17.
I mean, in terms of yachts from which I would like to steal champagne, if I had to rank them, I would say Joe Manchin's wouldn't be like at the very top. There are
Logan Roy's would be number one.
Totally. Yes. We would have to will succession to be real in a real way. But nobody wants to watch Rupert Murdoch do anything. He's not interesting to look at. Okay. Speaking of Hollywood, I guess, the WGA is on strike.
Erin, I'm telling you, earlier this week, talks broke down between the union that represents Hollywood writers, the WGA, Writers Guild of America, and Hollywood studios. 97% of the WGA voted to strike if such a breakdown happened. And now, more than 11,000 writers, countless builders, carpenters, caterers, drivers, and support staff are out of work and on a picket line as productions shut down. Erin, what is happening? Why? What were the studios not willing to give the writers of our favorite shows?
So let me just preface this by saying I'm a member of the WGA. I was one of the people who voted to authorize the strike, along with like 97.8% of screenwriters. And so when I'm talking about this, I'm not talking about it as like an organizer of the strike or anybody who is involved in negotiations. This is all public stuff, right? This is all stuff that like
all
the
public.
Writers Guild has put out. I've got no inside info, but I have been brainstorming signs for when I go hit the picket line later today. Okay, so basically every 3 years, the Writers Guild works out a contract with the studios. And our most recent contract expired on May 1st. And in the lead up to those contract expirations, there's some asks. Usually the writers are like, hey, we want this. And studios are like, yes or no or whatever. And or they come to some sort of compromise. This time around, from early on, it was pretty clear that negotiations weren't going very well. We don't always do the strike authorization vote. That's just something that happens if people on the negotiating team are like, maybe things aren't going to quite work out. And that's what happened this time. So we authorized a strike a couple of weeks ago when our contract expired on May 1st. At the end of the day on May 1st, no agreement had been reached, and so the strike was on. The strike is about a few things, but you can boil it down to say it is about screenwriting, writing for TV and film as a viable, sustainable career. And it has become less viable and less sustainable over recent years as studios have abused various workarounds in order to pay writers less, hire fewer writers, and basically pocket the money that writers' content is making them. So here's an example. Residuals are a huge thing. It used to be, if I wrote an episode of like, Who's the Boss, right? It aired, I would get paid for that script. I would get paid for every time the show that I wrote aired in rerun on TV. So it used to be that if you wrote for a show that went into syndication, you would get fairly sizable residuals checks every year. They would be like sort of a sustainable base income, because when you're a writer, you go a really long time without working sometimes. Sometimes you go months. Some people go a year or more between projects. It's really competitive. Shows go on hiatus sometimes. And sometimes people are just like looking for work in a new room. And it's a very feast or famine type of work. So residuals are really important for making sure that writers were able to be fairly compensated throughout their careers. With streaming, studios are just kind of pocketing the residuals. And so they're putting episodes of shows that writers wrote up on streamers, and the writer is not seeing any of that money. And so the Writers Guild is asking for a more fair system of paying residuals for streaming services. They're also asking for studios to stop abusing mini rooms, which is where fewer writers working for a shorter amount of time write fewer episodes, which means that there are less jobs. It means those writers who do have the jobs are getting paid a lot of times less than their minimum. It's really like a lot of people are getting cut out. And with a mini room, usually the people in a mini room are all like high-level writers working for a fraction of what they would normally make, and which means that people who are just getting started or who are mid-level writers are sort of being shut out of opportunities. It also means that the shows are kind of getting worse. I guess maybe you might have noticed that over the last few years, the quality of TV, while there are some real standouts, the overall quality of an average show, not high. And part of that is because studios won't pay enough writers and give them enough time to write actual good shows. So that's one thing. There's other asks too, like the use of AI.
Which is crazy. Erin, this was the part when I was reading through all the articles. There were two things that stuck out at me that I think people need to realize. One, that when writers, when you mentioned Who's the Boss, well, back in the day when Who's the Boss was on, that show was probably 22 episodes. So writers were employed for the entirety of an entire season of a show. Mm-hmm. Now, look at our favorite shows like Succession, 8 or 10 episodes max. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The other, AI, I couldn't believe, and you can expand on this, the Writers Guild wanted assurances of how AI would be used, that writers wouldn't be replaced with AI, that they wouldn't start a script and then AI would take it over. And Erin, I read that the Hollywood studios said, instead of that, we'll have a meeting once a year to explain technology to you. Truly one of the most offensive passback proposals I've ever seen.
Yeah, no, I don't know I don't know how they think this is going to go for them, because use of AI is like an existential threat to writing, and it's going to make shows that are bad. Like AI is going to write worse shows than what a human writer could write. It's going to come up with worse, stupider punch ups. There was literally an episode of South Park several years back where there's a robot called Funnybot that just tells jokes, and it's funny because South Park once again predicted the future. Yeah, the studio's response to that was really insulting. I am just – so like I said, I'm in the WGA, but I also, you know, I'm talking as a crooked host. So being a screenwriter is not the only thing that I do, you know. Right. But for a lot of people who are working in TV and film, it's like the only thing that they do. And the last time we had a strike like this was 2007, 2008, and it was like 100 days long. That doesn't seem like that long, but
It is. But also, Erin, what did the 2007 strike give birth to?
It didn't really give birth to anything. So I think that this is, I want to kind of like give a little pushback on the point that I think that you're making, which is that the Apprentice began airing during that, and that's how we got Donald Trump as somebody who played a competent businessman on TV, and people thought that was real life because it was reality TV, even though it was just fake. He basically just showed up to throw around racial slurs, sexually harass the female cast members, and then he went home. He wasn't doing business stuff. But that is true that the Apprentice kind of came to the fore during the time that there weren't any scripted shows being produced. But it's also true that reality TV was on the rise in the years before. Like, Survivor was a thing. American Idol was a thing. Like, you know, remember when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was, like, the show everyone was watching
on TV? Totally. Never a fan of it, but remember it vividly.
Yeah, I can still. And then The Weakest Link was another one.
Yeah. That was another. The Weakest Link.
Yeah, everybody loved a primetime game show for a period of time. So I will say that in the last writer's strike, there were they were filling in the gaps with reality TV. This time around, that's definitely going to happen. We're going to see some stupid, mm-hmm. bad reality try to take the place of the scripted shows that you like. But we're also going to see a lot of international stuff. Like Netflix just invested a ton in South Korean content. And South Korean content, all of the stuff that I've watched in the U.S., all the stuff that's made it over here has been, like, top-notch, and I've loved it. But they're not part of the Writers Guild. So that's one way around kind of what we're talking about here. So what we're seeing now is there's no late-night comedies, no SNL. Right. During the last writer's strike, Conan O'Brien sort of, did his show without writers. And it was, like, at one point, did you see where he, like, spun his wedding ring for as long as he could? So I'm hoping it gets resolved quickly just because of so many people whose livelihoods depend on this. I think that the economy of California stands to lose billions and billions of dollars. But also this is, you know, if you ask the WGA, this is an existential moment for them. Writing is going to be a gig job unless we get the writers get some of what we're asking for. That's kind of the long and short of it. And I talked about this for a long time.
Well, it's interesting. And I think people need to know the nuts and bolts of what's really happening.
Can we really quickly talk about E. Jean Carroll?
Yeah.
Okay. So writer E. Jean Carroll's civil trial against former President Donald Trump is currently happening. It's been happening for the last few weeks. She accused him of raping her in Bergdorf Goodman in New York in the mid-1990s. And the whole story of the alleged assault is really upsetting and awful. But the reason that she's suing Trump now is because when she went public with the story, he came out against her with just all manners of just slurs and
thuggery,
slams.
Thuggery.
It was really awful. What do you think she has a case? Do you think she's going to win, Alyssa?
I totally think she has a case. It's hard. Now, she's suing him civilly because here in New York State a couple years ago, even outside the statute of limitations of a criminal trial, you can now sue civilly. So she's suing him civilly. She can prove, you know, she has to prove that she was damaged by what he did to her. And
by what he said.
By what he said. And, you know, I think that she has a lot of, you know, she has a lot to stand on, but it's hard to tell. This is, you know, his lawyer is unloading on her in the grossest ways that you can imagine. So we'll have to see, but definitely sending her good vibes.
I have to agree. And we talked about on the show how the word badass is a little bit grating, but she's badass.
She is badass. I mean, she's reclaiming her shit, you know, in the Twilight. Do we call it the twilight of your life? In her golden years? I don't know.
In her golden, we'll say her golden years.
Like her golden-ish years. And you have to hope that she gets this vindication.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we have an interview that you are not going to want to miss. So stick around. And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast where we can guarantee no men will interrupt at any time. Our guest today is a writer, researcher, and journalist. She's the host of You Must Remember This, a history podcast diving deep into the forgotten stories of Hollywood. Karina Longworth, welcome to Hysteria.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, I'm a huge fan. I have been listening to your podcast nonstop for weeks. So I feel very parasocially engaged with the work that you've done. We're really excited that you're here today. The most recent seasons of You Must Remember This focus on sexuality and gender dynamics as they play out on film in the 1980s and 90s and how resentment toward the advances of feminism of the 60s and 70s play out on the big screen. What are some of the most iconic examples of that resentment? And what's a horny 80s or 90s movie that you think deserves a second look and why?
Okay, well, in terms of iconic examples of resentment towards women, I think Fatal Attraction is probably the ultimate. And then there's quite a few movies that were made dealing with similar things that were made primarily because Fatal Attraction was a hit. Films like The Hand That Rocks the Cradle and Presumed Innocence. And, you know, ultimately you can file Basic Instinct with that as well, although I make the case on the podcast that Basic Instinct kind of changes the game.
Mm-hmm. How does Basic Instinct change the game?
Well, the thing that was so powerful about Fatal Attraction and some of the other movies that were like that is that they reminded people who are watching it of their real lives. They felt like situations that could happen to them. And with Basic Instinct, everything is so heightened and so, like, just enough steps away from people's actual reality that you lose this kind of ripped from the headlines, ripped from real life feeling, and it becomes more of this erotic fantasy or erotic nightmare. And as I said, there were quite a few movies that were made that were able to kind of replicate the Fatal Attraction formula and be very successful. And when people tried to replicate the Basic Instinct formula, it wasn't as commercially successful.
Mm-hmm. You were very... I was surprised when I listened to your episode on Pretty Woman on how you seem to really have a lot of affection for the film. Can you talk a little bit about why you feel that kind of affection for a movie that a lot of people find problematic?
Yeah, I've always liked Pretty Woman. And, you know, as an adult, because it came out when I was 9 years old and I first saw it when I was 9 years old in a movie theater, and I've seen it many, many, many times since. And as I became an adult, I became aware of the fact that people found it problematic and that as somebody who considers myself, you know, supportive of women's rights, I guess, I'm also supposed to find it problematic. And I just never did. And so when I was writing about it for this podcast for this season, I knew I was going to have to try to interrogate what people thought about the movie that I didn't agree with and sort of figure out why I had never felt that way. And so, you know, in watching it in, you know, recently in my early 40s, I mean, I've really been able to kind of deconstruct it as a version of a 1930s romantic comedy. And a lot of movies of the 1930s would use things like sex work or transactional relationships kind of as a MacGuffin, as an excuse to get the story started or as a metaphor. And I think that the way it's used in Pretty Woman is more on that metaphoric level of using it as a way of talking about imbalances and transactional aspects between men and women who are not engaging in actual sex work. And I think that's really fascinating and really powerful and actually kind of universal.
Cool. Okay, so right now you're talking about Fatal Attraction in this season. Are you in the erotic 80s and 90s series? Fatal Attraction is now being rebooted as a series for streaming. And we're also kind of in a moment where it feels like we're kind of experiencing some more backlash to gains that women have made. Do you think that movies are reflecting like what's coming in the future? Is another backlash politically coming? And can you see that in cinema?
Well, I don't know if you can, you know, use the term backlash, because I don't know if it's exactly the same as when Susan Faludi was writing about the backlash in her context. But I think that whatever it is, it's already here. I mean, there hasn't been a time in my lifetime when women's bodies were less valued and we had less autonomy on sort of a federal level. As far as whether movies are reflecting it, no, I don't think American Hollywood movies are reflecting it at all. I haven't seen the Fatal Attraction TV show. Generally, I think American mainstream movies are not really very interested in adult women at all. TV is a little bit more so, and sort of streaming movies a little bit more so. But generally, mainstream movies are interested in teenage boys.
Hmm. Well, let's get into a little bit of how the sausage is made when it comes to your show. So you did a season focusing on Gossip Queen's Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons a few seasons back, and you talk about how the phrase behind the scenes actually is just a curtain that shows you another scene. So in the spirit of trying to get some true behind the scenes, how do you select topics, and what's your research process like for your podcast?
It's really difficult to select a topic for a season because I know I'm going to have to be living with that material for usually about a year. And because the research is so extensive, it has to be something where I know I'll be interested in it for that long. And it also has to be something where I know I can bring something to it, and not just kind of be reiterating old stories that people know. So it just takes a really long time. It takes a lot of reading, and it takes kind of finding a kernel of information that I'm interested in and kind of teasing it out and going down rabbit holes until I figure out if there is kind of a new story there or a story that I can approach in a different way. And then once I find that, I figure out, you know, how many episodes the story would sort of naturally be told over. And so I break it down into a season of however many episodes. And then I have to kind of commit to a date of when I'm going to do it so that I can give myself like a finite amount of time, because otherwise I would just continue reading and writing forever.
Same. I was also curious listening to this season. Some of the movies that you talk about are like not good movies, but you give them respect and attention and real estate, and you respond to them and you engage with the material. So how many times do you have to watch every movie that you give your analysis on? Like, how many times did you have to watch 10 and 9.5 weeks and the aforementioned Fatal Attraction?
I mean, we have a difference of opinion, because I think 10 and 9.5 weeks are great. But, you know,
I tried to stream it, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have to like purchase this, and then I'm going to probably end up on some kind of watch list because it's going to be the first movie that I've purchased in a really long time.
Which one? Nine and a half weeks?
Nine and a half weeks. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a beautiful movie. As far as how many times I have to watch them, I mean, maybe twice. It depends on the movie. Some of them I've seen before and I have kind of a familiarity with, and others I don't. You know, I definitely would watch it once to kind of figure out if I'm even going to include it in the show. And then maybe I'll watch it again, taking notes. And then sometimes I have to kind of like, you know, scroll through it again to pull clips for the podcast.
Mm-hmm. So you talk a lot about stories behind famous people that maybe people in modern day aren't totally aware of, like Clint Eastwood. I learned a lot about him from listening to you discuss him on your podcast. In that spirit, who are the biggest assholes that Hollywood and history have given a pass to?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, obviously, like, we have a different sense of what it means to be an asshole now than at different other points in history. You know, men got away with a lot of things in a lot of different ways that they don't anymore. And even this story of Clint Eastwood that I talk about, where he kind of unceremoniously dumped his girlfriend Sandra Locke while she was directing a film and then kicked her out of their house, which ultimately led her to sue him twice. You know, that kind of thing, the fact that it was happening and it was so public, it's really hard to imagine that happening today unless you compare it to something like Johnny Depp and Amber Heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the best and most popular series, in my opinion, that you've done is Charles Manson's Hollywood, which Caroline and I are both big fans of, our producer. I've always wondered if Manson was a manifestation of the most extreme versions of what makes fame, like a magnetic personality, a middling amount of talent and connections. But when those things didn't work out for him, he resorted to the most, you know, dramatic and overwrought possible response. If Dennis Wilson had been able to secure a record deal for Manson, would all those people be dead?
Wow. Well, I agree with you on your read of Manson as sort of, in some ways, he's emblematic of a lot of people who come to Hollywood, with a dream. And that's kind of how I tried to frame that season, because I'm not really interested in true crime. I'm not really interested in murderers. I was kind of chiefly interested in this idea that there is one connection between Doris Day and Charles Manson, and explaining that whole story. And then, of course, Dennis Wilson is part of that as well. And I think his music was incredible, and he's a fascinating, tragic figure on his own. But yeah, I think it's absolutely fair to say that if Charles Manson had gotten a record deal, he would have, it's certainly like there was a number of dominoes that had to fall in order to have all those people end up dead. And, maybe one of those dominoes would not have knocked down all of the others, you know, if he had gotten what he thought he wanted. But at the same time, I mean, he was a person with incredible delusions of grandeur. So, you know, what if he got the record deal and nobody cared about his album?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Maybe it could have been more people. So from listening to your podcast, it seems like film is both your passion and your job. So what media do you spend your time on when you want to decompress and not think about work?
I wish that I had the ability to do that. But what I actually like it, get excited about watching old movies and thinking about all of this stuff. And so, I guess like I watch some of the same shows that everybody else does, like, you know, Beef and like, you know, new shows. But and I don't know that I'm totally turning my brain off. I mean, I think I'm always kind of thinking about how art works and what it is saying about the world we live in. But that would be, I guess, closer to turning my brain off than when I watch, you know, pre-code movies from the 1930s on a Saturday night.
What future topics could you see You Must Remember This tackling?
I can't say for sure because right now I don't have any, and I'm still going to be working on erotic 90s pretty much until the rest of this year. But I recently read one of Julie Andrews' memoirs, Homework, and I find that her relationship with her husband, Blake Edwards, to be really fascinating. So that like that could be in there. I did this season on Polly Platt, who was married to Peter Bogdanovich and who was a production designer and screenwriter and producer in her own right. And that was based on an unpublished, unfinished memoir that she had left behind when she died. And I would love to do anything like that again. You know, I get really excited by this, the idea of a piece of writing or a piece of information that hasn't been seen before, you know? So I'm kind of always on the hunt for something like that where I could take it and flesh it out and bring the historical context to it.
Karina Longworth, thank you so much for taking the time, and we look forward to the rest of this season of You Must Remember This and future seasons. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, and this is another installment of Personal Political, the segment that takes things personally. Alyssa, when's the last time you were rejected?
Well, if we're talking about by my cats, that's daily. But other than that, you know, I think 2004 was my really bad last rejection, but 1994 was the worst of all time.
It's funny to me that you remember your last rejection as happening in 2004 when you work, like your day job is within
industry of rejection.
I don't
take that shit seriously. I can't.
Oh,
also, antidepressants and SSRIs have helped.
I need to get into that. Let's bring in the rest of our panel, both of whom are familiar with rejection and hopefully have better memories of it than Alyssa Mastromonaco. Our first panelist is helping to organize an event called Here for the Kids, which hopes to end gun violence across the states. For more info, go to thekids.com. She's also an actor in the upcoming film You Hurt My Feelings, premiering May 26th. Michaela Watkins, welcome to Hysteria.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm so happy to be back here in person.
I know.
It's just so meaningful.
You've been globetrotting.
I know, we've done it. Well, not just that. I mean, you know, I feel like I've just bookended the pandemic finally because I think I was meant to come in and then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then we had to shut it down.
Yeah. We were like, we're temporarily shutting down the
office. Yeah. And then we tried this lame-o cocktail hour on Zoom. Remember? That was, we gave it our best.
We really did try. Remember? Do you remember pandemic cocktail hours?
Yeah.
Like, we were all doing that for a while.
Yeah.
Imagine. I mean, now I think people are drinking on Zoom, but they're not making a thing of it.
Right.
They're just doing it.
But thank you for plugging Here for the Kids. Because it's a June 5th in Denver event, and basically we are 25,000 women, mostly white women, led by Black, Indigenous, women of color, brown women, who are leading the way, following the civil rights playbook, basically the abolitionist playbook for of slavery, and we're taking it to the guns because they're just out of control and they're the number one killer of kids. So that's why it's called Here for the Kids.
Amazing.
So, if you can sign up, and it's a movement. Keep supporting. You know, I still am supporting Everytown and Moms Demand. This is not a either or. This is a and.
Mm-hmm.
This is a let's all come together. We all have the same goal, which is to save save our kids. So
are you going to go to Denver for
I absolutely am going to Denver. And it's, by the way, a sit-in. It's not a, there's no marching, no chanting, no megaphones. It's, I'm bringing my knitting. I'm bringing a chair. I'm bringing like white lady things, you know, oat milk latte. I'm not going to wear Lululemon. That won't be happening.
That'd be comfy but, though for sitting. Lululemon you know is what? Nice and stretchy.
Okay, strike that. I'm going to go get some Lululemon. And basically, you know, we forget white, since we have a panel of white women today, I can say to us that, you know, we are the biggest voting bloc and we forget our power. And so we have to put it to use and stop standing on the sidelines going, can you believe it? Now we have to, we can get all our rights back. We can end gun violence. We can get our repro rights.
Yeah.
So many
as
things.
As Samuel Alito said, we can always just vote, right?
Well, it's more than voting, like, because we're going to, we have a direct action. We're going to demand no more gun sales and issue a buyback. So we can do this.
Amazing.
But everybody has to show up.
Yeah. I want to go to Denver. I want to do that.
Oh, please,
Mama,
please.
I want to sit with some knitting. That sounds awesome.
Yes.
Rounding out our panel today, our next panelist is going on the road with her show, That's Messed Up, an SVU podcast. They're performing in June and hitting San Francisco, Tempe, Denver, and L.A. For more info, go to thatsmessedup.live.com. Kara Klink, welcome to Hysteria.
Thank you so much for having me back in person.
Back
this
in
is
person.
Exciting. I said the last time I was here in person, I had a new baby, and she just turned four.
What? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God. Time. What is
time.
It?
Time.
I saw Kara yesterday at the most yes. star-studded playground yes. in our neighborhood. So
I actually met an actress at the playground yesterday. Well, we had met before, and I was like, you know, I was just talking about you because I'd love to have you on my podcast. It's about Law and Order.
You saw her yesterday?
I, like, booked a guest at the playground yesterday.
That's hilarious. Okay, so we live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of, like, parents who had kids after 35.
Excellent.
You know, like, working in
how dare you?
I know.
It just
I mean, that sounds gross, but keep going.
Well, it's a lot of people who are like Hollywood adjacent, but not necessarily like the flashiest people. And yesterday I saw an actor from How to Get Away with Murder at the playground with her beautiful child. And she was really dressed down, but I was like, I know who
just
you are.
Like us.
I know.
Getting away with murder is just like us.
I know, I know. And then I saw like a really famous influencer with her two children.
Ooh.
She was super nice and she was just like not wearing any makeup and she looked just gorgeous. And I was like, oh God, I can't come to this playground anymore. Everyone's too glamorous. It's like they should put a red carpet in the entrance
yes.
to the playground because it's really, that's really funny. Okay, today we're going to talk about something that I think all of us except not Alyssa Mastromonaco are pretty familiar with as people.
Must be great to be Alyssa.
I was kidding, by the way.
Well, we're talking about rejection. There was an article in the New York Times about, right now it's like college letter season, right? And people are getting into their dream college or getting rejected by their dream college. And when I was in high school, what we used to do was just not talk about it ever again. But now the kids are having, like, rejection parties.
Oh, yes.
Where they're having, like, cakes that are like, I didn't get into Stanford or, you know, or I didn't get into UC Irvine or whatever. And they're kind of taking back control. And I think that that's kind of beautiful in its own way because I don't know that I could do that with run-of-the-mill rejections that I suffer from day to day. Alyssa, I would love to hear the story of your big 2004 rejection and how you feel about it today.
So just to be clear, in 1994, I was one of those kids who got like 10 rejection letters on the same day. And you know what? Here's the thing about rejection. I'm always like, great. If I had gotten into Cornell, Brown, or Georgetown, would I be the person I am today? No, I'd probably be an asshole. So I turned out for the better.
Georgetown rejected me too. Alyssa, what's up?
Me too.
I didn't even apply.
Fuck the Hoyas.
Fuck them Hoyas.
And when I met Dan Pfeiffer, I was like, oh, you went to Georgetown, didn't you? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, okay. I was like, well, I went to UVM and smoked a lot of pot, and I'm still here next to you.
See?
2004, we had just lost the Kerry campaign, which was not like rejection. See, I'm also very clear about like the difference between losing and rejection. But I was unemployed, and I'm like, what am I going to do? And I was in the middle of this like real competitive like job hunt. Like there were like three people up for this job to be the political director of something Bono was doing. And I had made it to the end. It was like one of two, and they ditched me, and I was devastated, also very poor, had no money, totally unemployed, and I was really hanging my hat on this. But then I ended up working for Barack Obama. So yeah. It was kind of okay. Whee! But that one was really wounded.
Being rejected by Bono wounded you?
It was, well, yeah, because I thought I was better.
I mean, you know, first of all, you are better than Bono. And,
not just the guy who beat me.
So was it traumatic when Apple just dropped that whole YouTube album on your phone without you asking?
Honestly, I felt targeted. I felt targeted, Kara.
Oh, my God. There's an old joke that our last name is Ryan, but we're not big U2 fans in the house where I grew up. And there's an old joke. What's the difference between Jesus and Bono?
What?
Jesus doesn't think he's Bono. Oh, we're going to get some angry hate mail from very, very sincere, earnest U2 fans. And I'm sorry, that band sucks. Okay.
How dare you?
I know. They're bad. They're bad. I can't.
Hard disagree.
I can't.
Wait, there's not like a couple songs you think are good?
There's a couple songs that are good.
Oh, The City of Blinding Lights is like
okay. Here's another. I also think the Red Hot Chili Peppers suck. They've just written the same song over and over again. Some versions of that song have been
like
good.
The first, when I saw them go on tour in 92 or 3, I guess, maybe 2.
Like, were you at early Lollapalooza, Michaela?
Oh, I was at the first Lollapalooza. Oh my God, the first one where Jane's Addiction headlined.
Oh my God.
Yes. Girl, you know it. Yes,
this woman belongs in a museum. Anyway, we're gonna get back on track talking about rejection, but I reject Bono.
Yeah, I was like, this podcast is just Aaron rejecting bands that were popular in the 90s.
I've got a lot of opinions, and I'm gonna share all of them right now. Michaela, I'm very interested in hearing your experience with rejection and your attitudes around rejection, because when I think about acting and comedy and doing like live stuff, it just feels like such a vulnerable profession.
It's like it's seated in rejection. I mean, basically, like acting and performing are rejection is the baseline, and then when you get something, that's the unique part. You know what I mean?
Did you have to like reprogram your brain?
The unique part isn't getting rejected. The unique part is getting a job.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm so comfortable. I was expecting to be rejected because, you know, the old adage, like when a door closes, a window opens, it's like, so I didn't get the job, but I got in front of the casting director. My biggest rejection, to me, the one that was on such a public display, was when I didn't get asked back for my second season of SNL after a year that I thought I was good, you know?
Yeah, you had a lot of like clippable, I remember seeing you and your sketches were in a lot of times you were like featured, like, oh, check out what happened this week on SNL, and it was always like you were in the
mix. Was very shocking.
Yeah, it was
very shocking to those of us that watched the show.
It was
like my family was like quoting your sketches. We were like, wait, where did she go? What happened?
Oh yeah, the blogger. How did that happen? Like, how did they let you know that you weren't being asked back?
In an unkind way.
Oh.
No.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. Everybody got their contracts renewed, and I didn't, and Casey Wilson didn't. And she called me, and I had no idea that people had gotten their contracts renewed. So she called and said, did you get your contract renewed? And I said, no. And she said, everybody else did. And I was like, and then that pit, you know.
Yeah.
And then my manager, of course, called, and they said, oh, no, we love Michaela. Of course we're having her back. And I thought, well, why are you doing this? This is unkind. And then I heard that they hired two new women, you know, brunettes, 10 years younger than me. And they were very
Who were these brunettes?
They were very SNL had like 14 men and 4 women. So I knew when they hired two new women, they weren't going to have, you know, 6-7 women because they just didn't.
I mean, that's just not how the population works. It is mostly, it is 14 men to 4 women in general.
So I thought, well, I'm out, you know, and I didn't think Casey would be. And I didn't even hear directly from Lauren. I heard from him via my manager. He told my manager. And, you know, he would
tacky.
But after saying, tacky, we want her back, of course. And that, it's like that.
Yeah. So it was really drawn out all summer. And I remember I ran into Rachel Dratch, who wasn't on the show anymore. And she was like, this is what they do. She said, it's like they're cats and you're a mouse and they just bat you around. And then when it seems like you're dead, they're like, kind of, then they like,
hey, wake up.
Then they renew your contract.
Oh my God.
And so I thought, okay, maybe they're just toying, fucking with me. I don't know what it is. And so anyway, long story short, you know, it was, my friend said, are you on Twitter? I said, no. And she said, you better get on Twitter right now because you're trending. And I said, oh, no, that's okay. Boy, was that the dumbest thing I ever did. Because that would have been the moment to join Twitter, you know, like right when it had just started. And you know. Anyway, but I felt so embarrassed and I felt so ashamed and I felt like the people who had watched the show, the people who didn't watch the show knowing I didn't come back would think, oh, she didn't come back because she's not funny. And the people who did watch the show and if they thought I was funny, they would think, oh, she must be an asshole. And so I just thought on the public view, I don't look like a winner here, you know. And there was so much kindness and so much love. But what happened was I was depressed and I came home and I was unemployment, or I filled out an application for unemployment to the degree that I did an audition. And I always like to reuse paper. I did an audition for this really, really bad medical show where like she had a hematoma and then got hit by a boat and then was like dying and then went in a coma. And then like her, you know, it was turned out she was having an affair and so we tried to kill her. It was like everything that could have happened
was
to this one
woman. Was it Days of Our Lives?
So it was like, I got the part. But anyway, I realized because I very, this is, to deal with rejection. After every audition, I very ceremoniously throw out my sides, my audition papers. And when I threw them out after the audition, I saw on the back of it, I had printed the EDD form, the unemployment form. And so when I'm standing there holding my papers, the producers are watching my unemployment form on the other side.
Oh my God. That's the unemployment form should be on the other side of every audition side. Like just, you're going to need it.
But to put a fine point on this, I got together with a friend of mine. We were both depressed, unemployed, and I felt very embarrassed and ashamed, and we wrote a pilot just to see if we could, and it got picked up, and it went for a season, and we were executive producers on a series, and I didn't even know I could write. So you know what I'm saying? A door closes, a window opens.
Yeah, that's
yeah. And both you and Casey have had amazing careers.
Yeah, and now I really love my career. I genuinely
and a lot
love
of the people
career.
That have only been one season people on SNL have done really great things.
Yeah, I think if you have grit, and I think we come into the world with it. Or we have to develop it. But I think if you didn't come into the world with it, please develop it because I love my career right now. I love it so much. And I'm so grateful for it. And I think the people who do one season on SNL go and do other things because they don't want to be remembered as the person who had one season on SNL and nothing else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Kara, same question for you. What was your, like, biggest rejection you're comfortable talking about?
Oh, my gosh.
How did it play out?
I mean, it's not even, like, a comedy thing because, like Michaela said, like, for me, I auditioned for so much stuff in New York, I remember, and I just would forget about it the minute the audition was over. I was like, I can't think about it because I'm not getting any of this stuff. And then somebody calls me and says, you got it, it's like, what a fun surprise. That's, like, I feel like a self-protection thing you do from rejection. But a huge rejection for me, I am not athletic at all, but in where I grew up, it was like you had to do sports, and I played freshman field hockey, and then I tried out for junior varsity field hockey sophomore year, and I didn't make the team, and it was like, I just remember Like, I'm getting, like, a full body, like, sensation of, like, lying in my twin bed at home being like, this is so embarrassing. Like, I can't believe I got cut from JV. Like, and I don't care about sports. I'm not good at them, and I don't care. I don't know why. It just felt like such a everybody knew who got cut from stuff, and it was like.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Kara, I got cut from JV field hockey.
Thank you. I knew this. I knew that.
And
I knew
that was
we had
terrible.
That.
And I will say that was humiliating.
Yeah.
Humiliating. Yeah. Your name's not up on the piece of
yeah,
paper.
Yeah. And I don't know why I even, it's like looking back, I wish I could have told my younger self, like, oh, you don't care about sports and sports are not going to matter at all. Like, you're not going to play them in college. You're not going to, like, you know, but.
Did you ever think that you were going to play them in college? Or was
no.
this just like a random thing that you were like, I'm going to waltz right in?
And- I think it was a big part of the social like and like the structure of school was just like you're on the field hockey team or you're on the softball team or you're on the volleyball team. And like I was like, what team am I on now? You know, what am I? And then it's like, oh, I'm going to like work on the newspaper and be the editor of the yearbook and do the things that I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So. But yeah, I remember like my mom trying to like talk me off the ledge about it. And I was just like, you don't understand. I didn't make field hockey. Like,
oh man.
Well, because remember back then, field hockey, you went away to camp. There was like field hockey camp over the summer and you traveled
sorority.
With the boys' soccer team. And you went to, it was a whole thing. That was a.
And field hockey was kind of like.
That's still fresh.
Yeah. And field hockey was kind of like. The cool girl, hot girl sport, at least where I went to school. And so I was like, I'm not one of those people, you know? Like, I was like, I've been told I'm not hot nor cool. So,
yeah.
Neither hot nor cool.
Okay. I just remembered something. You just reminded me. I got cut from my theater program at Boston University, by the way.
What?
Yeah, this is major. I went to an acting conservatory, and after sophomore year, they do cuts. You can still graduate because they started something called theater studies. So I did. But I was cut. I'm one of two or three people in my class who are acting still.
Oh my gosh!
Of everybody, and now the university keeps asking me to, you know, come back and be part of it. I'm like, oh, now you want me?
Like,
But I only say this so that your listeners can hear. Like, you don't know in the moment. The rejection is not a be all end all. It's going to feel like it, but it is not.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely is not. You have no idea what. It's just part of your becoming. That's all.
Mm. I think part of it for – so there's, like, professional rejection, which I think that there are, like, concrete steps where, like, I tend to try to take my sadness or disappointment and channel it into something else. And that has led to me, I think, being able to do a bunch of different things to make money, which is, like, good because, you know, when we have stuff like an implosion of digital media and a writer's strike happening at the same time, I'm like, oh, cool. Well, I know how to – I have a podcast because I learned how to do that on the heels of something that didn't work out for me. But I think that something that's a little bit harder to deal with is, like, social rejection. And I feel like the things that stung me the most throughout my life have been – like feeling socially rejected. Everybody has that experience, that formative experience in middle school, or it's usually the eighth or ninth grade,
ooh,
I think, for girls.
Seventh for
grade,
me was a nightmare.
Tenth grade.
Sixth grade.
Right. I think anywhere between, 6 and 11.
A friend drop.
Yeah. You come back from summer vacation and suddenly your friends aren't your friends anymore.
Yeah.
Or there's one person who you kind of always didn't really get along with and they're the new queen bee and they're having sleepovers and everybody is invited to the sleepover except
it's
you.
It's horrific.
And then like,
it's a hellscape.
And then so you're just very like, you feel very rejected and you don't know what you did wrong and your old best friend is now the best friend of this person.
Yes.
Because, and then, preach. You know, and there aren't very many people in your class and so you have to be friends with the weird Christian girls and you join the cross country team because you're
or
too
the bad girls and that's when you start the bad stuff.
Well, I joined the Christian girls because they did like lock-ins and they had like youth group sleepovers. And I was like, well, I'll be included if Jesus doesn't reject anybody.
If they lock the door, if they lock the doors, they can't make me leave.
Yeah, they can't. This is a church, man. You can't reject me.
I joined the bad girls and got felt up.
Oh,
all
no.
right.
Yeah, so, yeah. Man, I didn't
know. Two roads diverged in a wood over here.
But it was like really, and you know, it's funny because now that girl who's now a grown-up person, she and I are, like, friendly. You know, she's got her life back in, you know, the Midwest, and I've got my life out here, and we're friends on socials, and she seems like a really nice person. Like, we're not the same people we were in eighth grade. But in my mind, that is, it's just such a scarring experience that when I interact with her now, there's, like, a bunch of scar tissue that I'm like, oh, wait, no, you're fine. Like, this, I have to remind myself that you're not in eighth grade anymore, and this is actually fine, and she's nice, and you like her. It's like, it's just kind of a mind fuck. And then, you know, there are a couple times in college, like, you know, I went to a school where with a lot of field hockey players, if you will.
Gotcha.
and my section of my dorm my freshman year had a lot of field hockey types. a lot of, like, ponytails with ribbons in them, mm-hmm. you know, like that sort of type of person. And I didn't – that wasn't my – I'd never, like, been to a country club. I didn't know. Yeah, that's not me. But I felt like I wanted to be a part of that group because that seemed to be, like, what – how everybody at my school acted. And if I wanted to be successful at my school, I had to be a part of that group. And it just, like, didn't work out. And I kind of realized when there was sort of, like, you know, because freshman year, there's always this weird, like, your friends, your first 2 weeks of freshman year, you look back on it and you're like, it's weird that I hung out with that person.
Yeah, totally.
For, like, a week, we were best friends. But, like, you know, once the chips kind of fall, I ended up finding a group that I was able to be much more authentic with, and we're all, like, great, and we're all still in touch with each other. But it was, like, painful. That reshuffling was, like, very painful.
That happened to me right before I turned 30. I had dated someone for, like, 5 years, and we broke up. And the breaking up wasn't the worst part. It was that he was, like, very cool, and everybody loved him, and I just got dropped like a hot potato in Washington, D.C. People were having parties next door to where I lived, and I was not invited. People who I thought were my friends were like, oh, no. We're inviting him, so we can't invite you. And he was actually like, where's Alyssa? Like, why wasn't Alyssa invited? And they're like, oh, no, because it's, like, weird, and we choose you. And he was the one who's like, you're deranged. But it fucked me up so much. It's how I ended up getting my first cat, Shrum, because I was so deeply lonely and didn't know what to do.
Alyssa,
that
same fucking thing.
What happened?
No.
Yes.
It's fucked up.
Yes.
It was so – I was sick. I was the thinnest I ever was because I was – so broken, truly, from how everybody just turned
their backs on me. I don't think I've ever picked the man when I've friends have broken up. I don't think I've ever picked the man.
Yeah, me neither.
Well, DC's a fucking shitty place.
I had the audacity to break up with the, like, drummer of the band, like the one cool band in our sort of cool band in our school, high school. And I had the audacity of not getting back together with him after he'd been cheating on me. And I was persona non grata.
What?
Yeah. It's brutal. It was, I can feel it. I still get hot thinking about it. I was so devastated.
Yeah.
Devastated.
The monologues, and then I got rejected. The monologues I've written in my head.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. The things, the dressing down your mirror has received.
I'm sorry, Alyssa, I cut you off. Please.
No, I was just going to say, and then I was subsequently rejected by everybody on Match.com.
Oh, man. Online dating.
I was like, this is not for me. I'm getting a cat.
Oh, wow. That is a modern day rejection machine.
Yeah.
I missed it, but I
met my husband on a dating app.
Really? Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh,
OkCupid. I met him on OkCupid.
I have a lot of friends that have gotten married from OkCupid.
Yeah, but if I were like, I feel like dating itself, if you're just like, I just want to date, I just want to casually date, I think that kind of the younger generation is like, this fucking sucks and we hate it and we don't want to date or be around people at all. I think that social rejection, I guess this is one way that it ends up being positive, is that when I have felt rejected by groups of people, when, like, you know, sometimes in the past I've, like, run toward another group of people or run toward another person or run toward a relationship. But the most productive I've ever been is when I've focused on, like, no, I'm going to be okay with myself. You know, I don't really actually need to hang around. Like, why do I need a group of 8 people to go out to bars? It takes, like, you know, 10 times longer to do anything if you're trying to do it in a group. So I just kind of, like, figured out how to do things by myself. And now I am really, I hate everyone and I don't like doing anything with anybody ever. So the moral of the story is do less than what I've done. But yeah, I mean, I think that just developing the skills to appreciate being alone and understand, like, that you don't need to be around other people at all and you can get your happiness that way is something that can develop from, like, social rejection, I think.
There's also social media rejection, of course, which...
When someone that is like, really cool follows you, and then a couple days later, they don't follow you anymore.
There's that. There's, like, you put up a video that you probably think is cool. I mean, I'm so glad this didn't exist when I was younger, because while, you know, being dumped by your best friend in sixth grade was hell, I don't know what if you're, like, put up a picture, you know, a video of you singing, and you're, you know, and everybody... comments that you're a total idiot, loser.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's, God, that's awful. You know, it's wait, I put myself out there and it was rejected.
Oh, my God.
At such a tender age.
Yeah. Well, speaking of tender ages, Carrie, you've got a little girl who's, like, getting into school age. And how are you handling watching her start to, like, understand rejection?
It is weird because she will say something like, oh, so-and-so wouldn't play with me today. They just said they didn't want to play with me. And I'm like, oh, God, like, it hurts your little heart. But, like, I'm just kind of like, sometimes people don't want to play with you and sometimes you won't want to play with other people. And I don't know. I kind of just try to, like, keep it very light with her and give her the tools to, like, redirect her focus and not get too bogged down in rejection. It's, like, another thing, too. It's, like, my daughter is... If I don't say so myself, very cute.
Oh, but she's very adorable.
Very
cute. She's very, like, verbal, and people are like, you should put her in acting and stuff. I'm like, first of all, I don't want to be in audition rooms as a mom. I don't want to be doing that. I mean, but I'm also like, that rejection so early. Like, I don't know if I can expose her to all of that, you know? Like,
oh, yeah. The only people that seem to not – we did an episode on Nepo babies, and the pro-Nepo baby argument is that they've actually grown up around seeing what the industry is and what it does. Mm-hmm. And so they might have a more evolved ability to handle the rejection that's involved in it.
I don't know. I used to babysit for a pretty famous Nepo baby, and she went right from Yale to HBO. So I don't know if there's a ton of rejection for the Nepos. But but yeah, it is something that I feel like I put myself in my mom's shoes of, like, when I call her and I'm like, you have to come pick me up because, like, everybody kind of ditched me at, like, going to town or whatever. We used to just, like, walk around my town. And I'd be like, how am I going to handle that? And it's – I don't have a plan yet, you know? Yeah. I got to, like, read more blogs or whatever.
Alyssa, you've got a spirited niece. Has she ever had to deal with rejection? Like, what's her tack?
I'm not sure she has, and if she has, I'm not sure she knows it. She is a saucy little minx who likes to say, wee wee, you annoying. And I said, well, maybe you're being uncool. She goes, no.
Oh my God. My niece, okay, so I have one niece who is like four almost. And there is, this is a very funny story about their daycare. So there was a bully at their daycare that was, like, mean to all the kids.
Oh, we had a bully at the daycare.
Yeah, there was a bully at the daycare, and all the parents were informed, like, hey, there's a bully at the daycare. And the only two kids that the bully wasn't bullying were my nephew and my niece. And the nephew is a little bit older than the niece. And my sister-in-law asked the nephew, like, you know, why do you think that you weren't being bullied? And my nephew was like, well, because I'm very kind to others and I don't, you know, I'm always nice and whatever. And I always play with him. And she's like, okay. And as the niece, why do you think he left you alone? And she goes, because I'm too powerful.
She gets it.
I feel like that's sort of maybe a way to wrap up this conversation, which we could continue to have for, like, hours.
Yes. I have more rejection stories.
Oh, yeah. I have so many, but...
It's just, I mean, it's the line of work that we do. If you're a creative person in any way, it's just what happens. You just get rejected, and it's just part of life. But you just have to remember you're too powerful.
And it gets easier. It really gets easier.
It does.
Yeah. Because the reason I think it gets easier is the older you get and the more you live your life, there's more yeses than noes. Mm-hmm. That's the truth. Like, you've lived through more yeses, whether it's relationships or anything. There's been yeses, so many yeses. Mm-hmm. So, like, and the noes, the yeses start to stack up and outnumber the noes is what it is.
And also, in hindsight, how much did the rejection actually matter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, in the moment, it stung. But when you look back on it, you're like, all right, you know, we moved on.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a good note to end on. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Sanity Corner / I Feel Petty.
Whee!
And welcome back. There are no announcements for the class on this week's episode of Hysteria, so we're just going to get right into Sanity Corner / I Feel Petty, a.k.a. Sandy Petty. Alyssa, do you want to go first?
Sure. So, Erin, earlier you spoke to Karina, and she talked about Fatal Attraction. So Fatal Attraction has been rebooted as a series on Paramount Plus. And I was like, you know what? Lizzie Kaplan, love her. Amanda Peet, Pacey, a.k.a. Joshua Jackson. I'm like, I'm going to get into
what
it.
What a cast. I'm in.
Okay. Here's the thing. Only three episodes are out. The first two are really not exciting. But the third one, I was starting to doze off on the sofa. And I'm kind of in and out of sleep. And all of a sudden I look and I was like, oh, I guess the affair has started. And then I'm like, he brought the dog on the affair. Ugh. And it enraged me like nothing I have ever seen. He brought his family dog to the beach while he was having an affair with Lizzie Kaplan, a.k.a. Alex. And I thought it was like, obviously he's a fictional character, but I thought about it for hours. I couldn't sleep because of it. I'm like, what a betrayal. Why didn't he just bring the kid while he was at it? Like, the family dog is asleep on this woman's floor while they have movie sex. And I was like, this is absolutely, I may not be able to go on because this is such an affront.
Oh my God. You know how a lot of people were able to have secret families because DNA testing didn't exist, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like someone like that is allowed to have bring their dog to the affair because we haven't yet developed the technology to get dogs to talk. Like, he better hope that we never figure out how dogs
But does he think that the dog didn't see what was happening? That the dog wasn't traumatized? If anyone's out there having an affair, you best not be bringing your dog.
Do you think dogs understand, like, monogamy?
I think he understands that he lives
quite
with
loyal.
People,
yeah.
And that this was not his lady.
Okay.
Right? This
he
was not
usually
his lady.
Does that kind of wrestling move on a different lady. What's going
on
a here?
Different lady.
Yeah.
On a different lady. And I felt I just really felt that whole scene was in very poor taste.
Well, but the dog was like relaxed though and sleeping, right? And comfortable.
The dog can only sleep to the sound of humping. He's like,
I just felt bad for the dog. That dog's going to need therapy.
This is so funny.
Okay. That's a good, I feel petty. I think that is probably the least problematic thing about the Fatal Attraction franchise.
I always think I can't love Alyssa's brain more. And then you top it.
Oh my God. Okay. So I'm going to go next. This is, I feel petty / Sanity Corner. It's like a very petty thing that I find like very fun. It's bringing me joy. So there's a new law in Utah that requires porn sites to verify the ages of users before they enter the website. Apparently it's more than just like if you go to like drizzly.com and you need to be like, I'm 21. Like, it's more involved than that at Utah. So in response, Pornhub has disabled websites for people located in Utah.
No porn for you.
Yeah, no porn for Utah. But what's really, really
funny.
That's
why you can't have nice things.
I know. Yeah. Well, so Utah is famously very right-wing and religious. And there's a video, if you are in Utah and you look at Pornhub, that comes up and is like, hey, this is your government's like not, we're not going to do this, which is very funny. So here's a funny epilogue to that, right? You guys know what a VPN is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So according to Google Trends, the state looking up VPN the most, Utah.
Yeah.
They're all trying to disguise their IP addresses so they can still access their free streaming online pornography.
That is amazing.
It's funny because, like, who says that old white guys can't learn new technology?
Or girls.
They're all learning about VPNs now in Utah. Yeah. And so,
I mean, I feel bad for Salt Lake because, they're cool.
They are cool.
There's a lot of cool in Salt Lake. They have a lesbian mayor or something even?
I'm not sure about the city government of Salt Lake City, but I will say that it is a great place to visit. It's got a cute little downtown.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. I like Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
They deserve their free streaming porn, I guess. I don't know.
It's like they already have weak drinks, right? Like, can't they only put like one shot of alcohol in every drink? Like, it's very measured. It's like, let them watch porn.
That's honestly why Utah is one of my favorite places to go on vacation, because like I come back from vacation and I feel so healthy because it's like... it's just a huge pain in the ass to drink, you know? So it's like, okay, well, I'm just going to do other things like hike and like, you know, look at the sunset or
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
And not watch porn.
Right.
Read the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, know? Read the Book of Mormon. They have that in hotels there. Mm. It's, yeah, they're really serious about it. They apparently believe that it's real.
I know. When you go to Utah and you, I asked one person, I was like, oh, do you know where there's a coffee shop nearby? And they said, well, because they don't, coffee's not a thing, really.
They can drink they coffee, can drink but some coffee, people are like, ooh.
But they were kept saying, but have you been to, they kept trying to send me to the, everywhere I went where I asked where something was, they kept trying to send me to the big church.
What?
Yeah, the big one on the hill.
Oh, my God. You know, that they're all going crazy about a soda chain, like a fast food restaurant that serves soda in Utah.
Uh-oh.
I swear to God, I'm going to have to, we'll have to talk more about this offline.
But they're probably right. They're probably right about all of it.
It's a real, yeah, maybe. All right, Kara. Sanity Corner or I Feel Petty?
You know, I feel like the last few times I've come on, I've really done sanity. And so let's do petty today. I was just talking to another crooked employee before I came in here, Hallie, lovely person. And I was telling her about how there is, there's just a woman who, her daughter is in my daughter's class, and she is like a chef. So obviously she finds a lot of joy in preparing food, but she posts these bento boxes of what she sends to school with her child, and they are out of control. I'm like, your child's eating pickled cornichons, like what, or like pickled beets and cornichons, and like there's some kind of purple powder all over one of the things, and it's like pea powder and moon root and all this. I'm like, don't ever sit next to my child. She eats peanut butter and jelly every goddamn day. It's all she wants. If I gave her something else, she would revolt. Like, and it's literally like, you know, a little bit of like tahini, like all this stuff. I'm like, my kids won't try anything. And the fact that you're just shoving this in my face on your Instagram account, which I can choose to follow or not, I just am feeling very petty about people trying to give their kids gourmet bento box lunches. Just cut it out. Get down here with the rest of us.
Yeah.
With the GIF.
Yeah, that's, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I see these like it things that are like, here's some suggested toddler foods, and it's like stewed carrots, and it's like, she's not going to eat
and
that.
Then it's like, cut everything into shapes. It's like, who has time for this shit?
I barely have time to like microwave stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's real. I'm there.
But then
you.
Again, I also have this super picky child, and maybe her child eats freaking foie gras, and I'm just like a jerk. So, you know.
I would say if the child is eating foie gras, that child might be a jerk.
Yeah, that's pricey. I'm not getting my kids into that kind of stuff.
Also
okay,
immoral.
Michaela, bring us home. Sanity Corner
okay.
or I Feel Petty.
Well, this is actually really going to bring us home because I'm going to go full circle. So whereas Alyssa is talking about the dog in Fatal Attraction. So have y'all ever contacted a pet psychic before?
No.
Okay. My dogs, neither Fred nor I could bring our dog to an affair because they're not fit for society. One of my dogs is so loyal to us that he kind of hates everybody else. And the other, but mostly men, he hates men. And the other one hates women. So they've made our lives very stressful, but they're so awesome and they have real personalities. And I always feel like they're trying to tell me something. So I told this to a friend and she said, I know the best pet psychic, which I've been down this road many times.
Wait. I'm so into this, Michaela. Keep going. I'm so into this.
Let me tell you something. I've been down this road. I've been duped. Last person, I was like, wow, all this stuff is pretty spot on, and realized every single thing he said was on my Instagram page. So I just thought, okay, let's do this. No, she said, no, you know, I'm telling you. I talked to this woman who basically starts the whole thing with, what do you want? And I said, oh, okay, this is not like very touchy-feely. And I said, well, I just feel like, what did you say? I said, I feel like my dogs are trying to, your dogs aren't trying to tell you anything. They're not trying to tell you a goddamn thing. You already know what they're trying to tell you. What? I don't know. One of them has, I don't know, borderline personality disorder. The other one is like, she'll get better. But, you know, this is you. I don't know. Your guides are telling me right now they need medication or muzzle. And I was like, thank you so, so much for all this incredible insight. And then she just only wanted, she's like, but they're mirrors. What are you so anxious about? I'm like, oh, Jesus, here we go. So I, now we're talking about me. And she was so nasty to me. She was so mean. And I was like, this is hilarious. But also, I can't believe I'm at the end of 20 minutes. I ended up paying this woman, I kid you not, $110 to get yelled at and to be told that my dog, nothing, like, okay, my guides are saying medication. Okay, great. So, look, I'm going to look into medication is my point. But I just, I don't, pet psychics, like, what the fuck was that? And also, why do I keep going back to that well? I have never one time had an illuminating experience. I don't know. People tell me they have. And when they tell me, I'm like, yeah, you knew that. Like, you just paid, you know, there was nothing new for me to be. I just wanted them to be like, well, here's the deal. You know, you chose your dog and your dog chose you because you have to play out some karmic ritual that, and here's how it is. And they're saying, if you just go get that red stuffy, then they'll just be so happy and stop, you know, attacking people at the door. That would be great. Never has that happened. Anyway, they're bullshit. I'm over pet psychics. Okay. I love psychics. I love intuitives, but pet psychics can go fuck.
What about your friend that said this was the best pet psychic?
She was like, everything's a gift. Now you know. Now you know you don't like pet
She's
psychics.
She's like, I forgot to tell you I love getting yelled at. That's like, my thing.
Right. Now I know I don't love pet psychics.
Oh,
thank
my
you.
God. Yeah, what a gift that she gave you with getting yelled at. Oh, that would be an amazing character to write, like a really mean psychic.
I told my friend and she's like, we're writing this.
A yeah. mean pet psychic who's like, why are you even here? Why are you coming to my business?
No, but I said, okay, fine. If we're talking about me, you know, how's this going with like like some of my outreach stuff or activism. She's like, you don't need to do that. Somebody else can do that. I'm like, that is so antithetical.
Oh my God.
Activism.
So helpful.
Oh man. By chance on April 1st? Because it would be a funny April Fool's joke if you were a psychic.
No, it was on May 1st. Oh. It was on May Day.
Oh, no. So it's fresh.
Yeah.
The wound is fresh.
So fresh.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that is all the time we have for this week's episode of Hysteria. Kara and Michaela, thank you so much for coming by. Alyssa, thank you for being my ride or die. Thank you to Karina Longworth for the great interview. And listeners, thank you for listening. There will be more Hysteria next week.
Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Rustin is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer, and Fiona Pastana is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. Thank you to our digital team, Nara Melkonian, Mia Kelman, Milo Kim, and Matt DeGroot.
Hey, it's Erin. I have a podcast recommendation for you. From KCRW, Bodies is a medical mystery podcast with a feminist twist. It's a show that tackles why women and other people with marginalized genders are so often left in the dark when it comes to understanding their own bodies. In each episode of Bodies, we meet someone with a question about their health, and we follow them on their quest for answers. In this new season, we hear from people who are discovering their neurodivergence, facing down a postpartum mental health disorder, and preparing for their own death. Bodies episodes are intimate and thoughtfully produced. The show has been called life-changing by many listeners of the first three seasons. If you have a body and you're trying to figure out how to keep it alive and well in this patriarchal world, you'll want to listen to Bodies from KCRW. New episodes are out now wherever you listen to podcasts.